are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, June 11th, 2019. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America. Downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Associate Professor of Anthropology at Oxford University, Ruben Anderson. On No-Go World, how fear is redrawing our maps and infecting our politics. Also on the program today, federal judge orders the last abortion clinic in Missouri open for at least two more weeks. House passes IRS reform bill, killing the so-called free file program, which was a giveaway to tax preparation services. Meanwhile, Warren Buttigieg on the move in Iowa, Bernie marches with workers, and Joe Biden still thinks the fever will break.
They know better.
Jared Kushner's business got $90 million over the past 2 years from unknown offshore investors. Just that, folks.
It's working and it's very exciting.
It's getting really good. Wow.
New York may be the first state in the country to decriminalize sex work. And
oh, yeah.
South Carolina wants to add work requirements for Medicaid. Democrats pull a congressional pay raise bill because of pushback. And Reince Priebus joined the Navy. All this and more on today's program. Yes, that's not a huge story, Reince Priebus. You all remember Reince Priebus. He was the former chair of the Republican National Party. Then the became chief of staff, the first chief of staff for the Trump administration. And I don't know. It doesn't say in this. I haven't seen anything, any elaboration on this. But here's an
image. I'm going to a very ad hoc place in my thinking right now.
Sean Spicer tweeted out an image of Reince Priebus in his naval uniform getting sworn in by Mike Pence. So Priebus, age 47, he joined the Navy. He joined the Navy, and apparently he was commissioned after a process in where a former Defense Secretary Jim Mattis recommended him, and a board of officers selected him as a reserve officer. And he says, you know, I remembered my sister served as a Navy doctor and my father taught at the Naval Station. And he felt called to serve after an Oval Office meeting in which Trump met with his wife and children of Senior Chief Petty Officer William Ryan Owens, a Navy SEAL officer who was killed in a special operations raid in Yemen. So he was professionally recommended by a board with four others to join the service through a competitive direct commission program for human resources offices. Officer, I for the life of me, I don't know exactly what's behind this. I just hope that it is an indication that if you work for the Trump administration, no one will hire you in the civilian world.
I wanted to lobby Bayer to make it easier to put toxins in the waterways. They wouldn't give you a damn thing. The whole thing is garbage.
Maybe I'm he just wants to see the world.
Or maybe
get away
just...
from his surprisingly hot wife.
I've always wanted to see the Orient. What the hell is surprising about it?
That story is complete garbage.
But that's, I hope that's what it is. But I don't think that it's only that. There may be other things involved in this. Meanwhile, on the Hill yesterday, the House Judiciary Committee heard testimony from former White House counsel John Dean, who's obviously Richard Nixon's White House counsel, went on to write extensively about Nixon and about authoritarians in our government. That was 10, 15 years ago. He saw that the Republican Party was actually turning authoritarian. Saw the indications of that happening. And he's been, you know, brought on various capacities as a commentator. I'm not sure I fully get why. I understand the sort of the thinking, but it really is one-dimensional thinking and clever, too clever by half, I think, by the Democrats to do this. But it may be the best that they could do with Nancy Pelosi, and we will talk about Nancy Pelosi. We have that clip of her at Pete Peterson. Right? Oh, God. Anyways, so in lieu of impeachment hearings, we're getting this, which is apparently just to set the table. Now, of course, it did create some attention, and wherever there's attention, there is milkshake Matt Gaetz. Matt Gaetz loves a slushy on a hot Florida day. He is from the Florida Panhandle. And here he is questioning John Dean. He doesn't do a terribly good job, but he does get humiliated. And how do we know that Matt Gaetz felt he got humiliated? I will tell you after the clip.
Do you have personal knowledge regarding the truth or falsity of a single material fact in the Mueller report?
I think if you recall the first thing I said, I'm not here as a fact witness.
You're here to provide historical context.
Exactly.
And throughout history, you accuse presidents of acting like Richard Nixon and you make money off of it, right?
Not all presidents, no.
No, but a few more
than
one.
Those who do act like him, I pointed out.
Let me ask you this question. How do Democrats plan to pay for Medicare for all?
I'm sorry?
I figured if we were going to ask you about stuff you don't know about, we'd start with the big stuff. So do you know how they plan to pay for Medicare for all?
Who? The Democrats or which candidate or can you be more specific?
Let's get specific to Nixon since that appears to be why you're here. Do you believe?
Well, actually, Nixon did have a health care plan.
Good. Good. Well, do you believe if we turned the lights off here and maybe lit some candles, got out a Ouija board, we could potentially raise the specter of Richard Nixon?
I doubt that.
Well, it...
So now
sounded much better in front of the mirror, Matt.
Right, Matt Gaetz thought he was. Yeah, and basically he tried like three or four different tacks. I'm going to go to this. Oh, John Dean may actually know how these candidates are going to pay for their health care, and I certainly don't want that to happen. So let's talk about Nixon. Oh, Nixon had a health care. And they all laughed at Matt Gaetz. And what's even more important than my assessment that they all laughed at Matt Gaetz is Matt Gaetz's assessment that they laughed at Matt Gaetz. And how do I know that Matt Gaetz felt they all laughed at him? Because there is no intern in Matt Gaetz's office who would have made the decision on their own to edit that video and release it and hide the fact that John Dean owned Matt Gaetz in this exchange. Here is the video that has been put out by Matt Gaetz. This is eerie, folks. Eerie. 50,000 people have watched this, and they're missing the part where Matt Gaetz gets metaphorically slushied.
How they plan to pay for Medicare for all?
Who? The Democrats or which candidate? Or can you be more specific?
Let's get specific to Nixon, since that appears to be why you're here. If we turned the lights off here and maybe lit some candles, got out a Ouija board, we could potentially raise the specter of Richard Nixon.
There you go. They cut out that whole moment.
They made it sound as if people were chuckling at his weak joke.
Yeah, exactly.
Because they got the tail end of the laughter. Here's the part again.
Appears to be why you're here. If we turned the lights off here.
Specific?
Let's get specific to Nixon, since that appears to be why you're here. If we turned the lights off.
Orwellian, man.
Let's get specific to skipping me humiliating myself in a spectacular fashion.
Calling Vic Berger.
I'm
well,
that...
forget Vic Berger. This should be all over the news in Florida. That is pretty stunning that he would edit it that way.
Doctor in the public record.
Yeah, it really is. And there's 50,000 people who watched his version already. 50,000 people, and you can bet a lot of those are his constituents. Folks, one of today's sponsors is Skillshare. Anyone who goes to skl.sh/majorityreport4 is going to get 2 whole months of totally free access to Skillshare's entire library of super quality online courses and tutorials. Skillshare is a vibrant online learning community that offers courses on everything from design to video editing, photography, business, technology, cooking, meditation, everything in between. There are Skillshare courses for everyone. You'll have no problem finding courses that are going to be useful for you both in your personal life and your professional life. Whether you want to sharpen your skills with something you already love doing, or you want to learn how to do something totally new, Skillshare has you covered. They have courses for entrepreneurs, courses on computer coding, web development, personal nutrition. You can learn new languages, Photoshop. Check this one out. So I went to my Skillshare page. Welcome back, Sam. Ready for your next lesson. Here's the amazing thing. One, they gave me 2 options. One is intro your business social media strategy. I haven't taken that course, but I've been talking about courses like that. And the other one is lucid dreaming.
Nice.
But then they recommended some other ones for me, and they're all actually completely on point. Get Unstuck, Best Procrastination Once and for All, although I'm actually getting better at that. I just have no time anymore. Social Media for Creatives. A great social media strategy. Here's the best one. Here's the one that is the least likely, I would imagine, that someone would predict I would want. But make ahead breakfasts that will change your day.
That is very predictable.
Because I got to do this for the kids.
Highly predictable.
I got to do this for the kids. Anything I can prep to get ahead of my day, that's what I will do. But it gives you a whole range of different courses. And I've been happy with every single one I've watched. You can get 2 entire months of free access to every single course offered by Skillshare by going to skl.sh/majorityreport4. Think of everything you're going to have at your fingertips for 2 whole months. Again, that's skl.sh/majorityreport4. I put a link underneath this video. If you're watching on YouTube, it is, of course, going to be in the podcast description. Ladies and gentlemen, just a reminder, this program relies on your support. Sometimes we get a lot of members, and other times we don't get a lot of members. We're going through a little bit of a dry spell. So any type of support, if you listen to this show on a regular basis and you want to continue to, or you want to support it, help it grow and continue on, join themajorityreport.com. Join themajorityreport.com for just literally 35 cents a day. We've done the math before. I don't know why we can't remember it. 35 cents a day.
I thought it was 35 cents a day.
I think it's like 36 or 37. I don't know. But it doesn't matter.
Under 40 cents a day.
Under 40 cents a day, ladies and gentlemen. You can support this program every day. Go to Join the Majority Report. When you do, we give you extra content and we make it commercial free. Join the Majority Report.com. Going to take a quick break. When we come back, I'm going to be talking to Professor Ruben Anderson on No-Go World, how fear is redrawing our maps and infecting our politics. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program anthropologist and associate professor at Oxford University, author of, or his latest, I should say, is No Go World, How Fear is Redrawing Our Maps and Infecting Our Politics. Ruben Anderson, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Now, this is a follow-up to Illegality, Inc., a clandestine migration and the business of bordering Europe, which was largely an ethnography of migrants. And what, just how did that book lead to this one?
Right. So I was working as an anthropologist on undocumented migration towards Europe from West Africa for many years. That was what my first book was about. This is obviously a huge story in the news right now. Border security, fighting irregular migration, that kind of thing. We're seeing that at both the US-Mexico border and in Europe, and that's the story of my first book. So I was following border guards and their attempts to crack down on migration, build fences, launch patrols, including on African territory. And I was following migrants in the borderlands, trying to cross these borders. So the new book, No Go World, is about the same part of the world to some extent, about West Africa and the conflict, insecurity, instability that's hitting this part of the world right now. And I guess one thing that ties the two together is really this issue of migration and the politics of fear surrounding what's seen as uncontrolled migration from poorer countries towards the West. The way in which this ties into particular mapping of the world, into zones that are seen as sources of dangers, of threats coming towards Western borders. So I look at this both in the case of the US-Mexico border in the book and in the case of Europe, where we're seeing more and more investments in border security, more and more wall building and similar types of controls rolled out to halt these kinds of movements.
You talk about sort of red zones and green zones. Just just so that we are all on the same page. Like what does that mean, literally?
You may recall the old Baghdad green zone during the Iraq invasion. The idea of a bunkered up part of the city that's set apart from local society, where it's very difficult to enter for any locals. I think in a way we're seeing a globalization of this idea of the green zone today on a global scale, including at our borders, where we're gating up our borders, trying to keep outsiders away, anything that's seen as dangerous to our territories. Outside then lies the red zone, and we see that depicted very clearly on various kinds of risk advisories. If you go to the State Department or if you go to any foreign ministry website in Europe, you'll see maps of the world that are covered in red blotches of danger. Huge parts of Africa, parts of Mexico, Central America, large chunks of Central Asia are now no-go zones, out of reach, as it were, parts of the world we shouldn't go to. So we're seeing increasingly this division of the world, a peculiar mapping of the world into zones of safety and danger, in this sense, red and green zones. And I think this says something about our moment, this anxiety and fear that we see in our domestic politics in Western countries. And we also see, I think, here an echo of earlier times, even our colonial times, pre-colonial times, and the ways in which certain parts of the world were imagined back then. And part of what I do in this new book is to head back into history and see what we can learn from those earlier times.
Yeah, give us a sense of those maps. Like how, so there was, I mean, I feels like the maps in the pre-colonial times would not be, they would not be red or green. There would just be maybe a question mark, right? As opposed to, I mean, is that, I mean, how would you characterize if you were to oversee the, I mean, I guess to generalize the evolution of these maps, and these are obviously done from the perspective of largely of the West. What would that evolution mean? What would it look like both literally, but also what was the subtext behind that?
Yeah. So first to discuss the subtext there, it's important to point out that the mapping of the world, which I talk about centrally in this book, is not simply about depicting the world around us. It's a way of narrating our place in the world, of leaving out certain things, emphasizing others, telling a story about our place, whoever we are in that world. And it's also a way of justifying certain kinds of interventions in that world. And we see that going back all the way to medieval times. And what I look at in the book is the history of Western mapping to some extent. Maps of the world in medieval Christendom that situated Jerusalem at the centers, and far away on the margins you saw these monstrous figures adorning the edges of the known world. In a way, the blank spaces you're referring to that were imagined as inhabited by these strange, monstrous creatures. Here be dragons is that old phrase we often hear. Often the maps didn't say that, but they had all these beastly traces sort of written into the margins. And that persisted into colonial times. We see how in the early colonial periods, those blank spaces become spaces to conquer, spaces to understand, spaces to go out there and define and remap, as it were. And it's ironic that in the high colonial era, we see maps of the British Empire, for instance, where all the red zones indicate zones of colonial control. Those were the parts of empire. The empire painted itself red, as George Orwell said. Well, today, the red zones on our map indicate danger, they indicate lack of control. And they indicate, I think, a retreat as well. A retreat and a selective withdrawal of Western powers away from parts of the world where they have long sought to exert their dominance.
Tell us what about the Timbuktu syndrome? Because you know, much of what you're talking about, at least in the context of when we, in Africa, anyways, is around Mali.
Yes. Yeah, I spent some time in Mali for research for this book, where we've seen a conflict ongoing in the past years, and sadly violence is now spreading across the country and across the whole West African region into neighboring countries as well. This was a conflict that started in 2012 with a separatist uprising in the desert north of the country, around the ancient town of Timbuktu, of course, that's so well known as the sort of epitome of remoteness in the Western imagination, one of those blank spaces on the map that in the 19th century European explorers set out to visit and map and eventually through colonialism to conquer. So we're seeing in this part of the world insecurity, danger, threats of various kinds mapped out through different kinds of interventions. We have counter-terror interventions, we have border security operations, peacekeeping mission, and so on. And what I talk
can you,
about...
I'm sorry, just for the sake of our audience, those types of interventions, can you just flesh them out just a little bit so that people have an understanding of what typically had been, what those interventions took form? Because they're not simply... military, and they're all not, I guess... I mean, arguably, but they're not necessarily imperialistic. Although, for the to a large extent, I guess maybe they are. But will you just outline those for us?
On the one hand, since the Bush era, we've seen the war on terror extended into the Sahara Belt, the Sahel-Sahara Belt in Africa. Through counter-terror initiatives starting already around the time of the Iraqi invasion. That's an old thing, in a sense. It's been going on for a long time. And since that time, the early 2000s, we've seen an emergence and proliferation of jihadist groups and other militias and armed insurgent groups in the region. So that's one part of the story. And we then also have the French, the former colonial power in the region, coming in with its own counter-terror mission in this part of the world that overlaps as well quite uneasily, one can say, with concerns about migration in Europe. So even when this counter-terror mission is motivated officially in France, it's said to be about controlling a danger zone where all types of smuggling are taking place. It's partly to do with stabilizing this part of the world to ensure that migrants and displaced people don't move onwards to some extent. We then have border security, and this was also what I wrote about in my first book. More and more European Union funding, different European states investing in this part of the world, sending troops to some extent, but also police forces into the region. A lot of money going into the coffers of government, often with little democratic oversight, and directly into funding things like border posts, vehicles, all sorts of security equipment. In countries such as Mali and neighboring Niger, that is risking real escalation of the problem if the security apparatus of these states just keeps on being strengthened with few democratic controls. And besides all that, you have a UN peacekeeping mission, which clearly has more benevolent objectives attached to it, but that's seen itself in huge trouble in this part of the world, with record fatalities taken mainly by African troops who are out there patrolling the front lines in the desert north of the country with very little protections in a mission of uncertain end and facing increasing attacks by jihadists and insurgent groups. It's a very unstable part of the world right now where all sorts of security operations are converging in a very uneasy way, and that's partly what I get at when I talk about this Timbuktu syndrome in this part of the world. A way of intervening that's concerned with controlling various kinds of transnational danger in these far-flung, remote places of the globe, but that often are premised on not actually fully entering these zones, of operating in them at a remove through the remote controls from the inside walls of bunkers and headquarters and via drones and proxy forces and so on.
So, okay.
We've seen in this part of the world, it's not quite working out.
Well, all right. So what you're describing to us is this notion of you can draw maybe more of a straight line, arguably, with what Donald Trump purportedly was trying to get out of Mexico, which is to stop immigrants coming, not necessarily from across the Mexican-American border, but the Mexican and Guatemalan border, and to stop the flow of immigrants and basically to leverage stuff that was happening internally there. And I want to turn our focus to that more specifically in a moment. But the syndrome you're describing is a fear that's on the margins on some level, but in some way our interventions are done in a more are done in such a remote way that it makes these things more marginal and also more dangerous.
That's probably a good summary of it. Yeah, it's a bit of an echo of the Vietnam syndrome, if we'll bring that term in as well. The idea that the United States didn't want to risk its soldiers' lives in military escapades abroad after the large fatalities sustained in Vietnam. And we're clearly seeing an echo of that today. And that's partly why I talk about a syndrome here, in that we're seeing a reluctance, a political reluctance, a risk aversion to put large numbers of boots on the ground, to put in place a large-scale, say, military-civilian mission in these far-flung parts of the world. Instead, the idea is that we are now using these new capabilities to intervene remotely through technology, through drones, surveillance, but also through collaborations with partner regimes, partner states, as we've seen in the case of migration in Mexico and Central America, and as we've seen in the case of both migration and counter-terror in the Sahel and the Sahara. This is an old technique that was there already in colonial times, I should say, and it's not quite working out. We're rather seeing often uncontrolled, unchecked resources spreading into often very unaccountable regimes, and that often risk escalating the problem over the long term. There's less and less of a sense of control over what's happening on the ground, and the powerful interveners in their headquarters, military headquarters, policing headquarters, in the West or in bunkers in the field, often have a very limited view of what's going on there. And it's that separation, that withdrawal, that distancing that I think should concern us deeply.
I understand the dynamic you're describing, which is, you know, we're trying to intervene, but we're on some level, it's sort of like a one size fits all. It's not done as a sort of like an experience that is shaped by an understanding of what's actually happening there by interacting with people. But I'm unclear as to like what is it that we're doing. I mean, what is the central problem? Is it the intervention? Is it the mode of intervention? Is it that you're suggesting here? Or is it that we have done things that have created problems on the margins? Because it's also possible, and I'm not sure, you know, like of the perspective on how this is problematic, because there have been those, back in the early 90s in this country, the neocons, the Project for a New American Century, you know, proposed to a large extent a lot of what we're seeing now. It didn't necessarily work out in the way that they thought it would, it would create this sort of like American hyperpower hegemony by, you know, unchallenged hegemony, because, you know, in envisioning a series of low-level conflicts all around the world that were low-level enough that it kept people busy, it created some busy work for people in terms of, but nobody ever amassed power to challenge the United States. I don't know that the second part actually worked out from the perspective of those people, but certainly the first part seems to be there, right? I mean, if you pour enough guns, you start selling enough guns and you're willing to sort of like, drop with drones or, you know, packets of money or whatever, you can create some instability and, you know, still control it, you know, have a certain amount of controlled chaos.
Yes, controlled chaos is a good word for it. And I do go back in the book, actually, to the early post-Cold War moment when the neocons came out in force and said, we need to go abroad in search for monsters to destroy. And in a way, what we've seen since that time, that search for a post-Cold War enemy to take the place of the Soviet foe has come to pass, as you say. And we've seen this active conjuring of monsters on the margins of our map, in a way, that serve a certain kind of project here. So I think part of the problem, to come back to what you're saying, is with the way in which Western powers have intervened in these parts of the world for a long time and are fundamentally imbricated in the problems, in the dangers, in the challenges that we're seeing here. Through, as you say, arms sales into zones of conflict, we see that now in the case of Yemen, for instance, the kind of remote intervention we saw by NATO in Libya, deposing Gaddafi with no plan for the aftermath, which in turn led to a whole escalation of series of events, not just in Libya itself, engulfed in chaos and factionalism, but also across the whole Sahel-Sahara belt of states, which have long been patrons, or sort of dependent on the patron of Gaddafi, the patronage of Gaddafi. Tuareg Malians from the north of Mali who had been in Libya, coming south into Mali and setting the spark for the rebellion there that then led to the conflict in Mali and so on. And when I was out there in Mali speaking to people, speaking to the military as well in this country, they would point the finger directly at the West and saying that this is down to you that we're facing this problem. And there comes the other side of the equation, which is that interventions that are then put in place have not tended to improve things. Rather, they're imposing this distance that does benefit to some extent the external powers. It keeps the problem out of sight and out of mind for a time. It pushes the problems and risks elsewhere. It dumps them, as it were, in the global borderlands, in the blank spaces, far away from our shores. But at the same time, instability keeps growing, and we see the constant risk of blowback, of larger risks coming back to hit the fortified borders of the West, as it were. And I think we saw that in 2015 in the so-called refugee crisis, for instance, and to some extent in the chaos that's now spreading across the Sahel region.
To what extent is the creation of these sort of like marginal boogeymen, if you will, both imaginary and real? We've either created them out of whole cloth, or we've created them by destabilizing things, and or we've created certain problems. Like I'm thinking in terms of U.S. Intervention in Central and Latin America over the past, I don't know, 6-7 decades. Which has created instability, which has, in a large part, added to the desire for people to migrate out of those countries and to the U.S. And then, of course, they're demonized for domestic political purposes of a specific, a party or a president. Mm-hmm. But, to what extent is this also being used as a way of like sort of anticipating future problems? Like we're also, maybe not so coincidentally, we're seeing this instability in places which largely are also going to be implicated and are implicated now with climate change. And it's almost as if like, well, we might as well get this party started now. And start to build the walls because, summer is coming, I guess. And we should build the walls now. And the way that we get the walls built is by creating, maybe ginning up a fear, because frankly, there's going to be an even greater crisis down the road.
Yeah. To start off there, I should just clarify that I'm not saying that is simply a case of creating our own monsters. There are certainly many other actors with a responsibility here in the mix. That includes local actors in some of these countries who have a stake in the game. It includes, of course, the insurgent jihadist groups themselves and so on, criminal networks who all have their own violent means and objectives for doing what they do. So let's also remember that it's a complex mix of factors thrown in here. But we're often this future projection of a doomsday that we saw already in the 1990s has tended to, in a way, make things worse in the short run and setting us up for a bigger problem in future, I think. Let's just take the example of walling, for instance. When the first walls emerged around Western borders, both in the United States and Europe in the 1990s, the migration was taking quite different shapes. It was not nearly as dramatic as what we then started to see. I remember speaking to European border guards who reflected on this era and said, look, until the wall was up, this was in Spain, people just came walking across. And then suddenly we had this situation where now a large number of people just run at this wall all at once, having to be fought back by border guards in this really chaotic scenes invoking an emergency. And we saw a similar thing at the US-Mexico border with the so-called kamikaze runs at the same time. So then suddenly we had a crisis, and the crisis was in part created by the very wall that was there to supposed to stop the future crisis from happening. And I think there's a risk with that sort of doomsday thinking actually helping to create a doomsday coming into play when we talk about climate-related migration. In academia, we have a much more complex perspective on how climate change is going to impact on future population movements. It's not necessarily the case. You're going to see millions upon millions of people setting out on long journeys towards the West. The evidence is more complex than that. But I think there's a big risk that this gets simplified and turned again into a story of these encroaching dangers that we need to build a wall against, and that, in fact, will then lead to a worsening of the problem.
Do you think from a certain extent, I mean, that may be part of what is driving this policy, you know, broadly, to the extent that there's a policy or these policies that are leading to this sort of dynamic now?
Well, there's a short-sightedness to it, and you hinted at that in terms of the domestic politics here. It's quite easy to rally the vote if you can reassure a certain part of the electorate you're going to build that wall or what have you. And we see that in Europe as well, the most blatant example being perhaps the case of Hungary, where posters were put up to deal with migration and what migrants could and couldn't do in the country, but they were all in Hungarian, which meant any migrants or refugees in the country could not read these posters. It was clearly a message meant for the domestic audience. And right. Similarly, walls, fences, patrols, that kind of measure. The principal purpose of those tends to be to send a domestic political signal rather than halting migration in an absolute sense. In fact, evidence suggests in the United States-Mexico case that the huge investments in border security since the 1990s have led to a larger undocumented population inland in the United States, as people have stayed on over the long term instead of circulating back into right. Mexico as they did in earlier years.
Because they know that they can come back in for seasonal work and then go back home easily. They don't feel the same pressure. In fact, there's the theory right now is that the reason why we are seeing greater numbers of refugee seekers right now is because there is a sense that the door is starting to shut totally, and people need to get there now. So, is there a specific phenomena that's happening around the world that there seems to be a trend in this way, or is it just that one leader looks and sees what another leader is doing and seeing that it may be successful there, or is there a sentiment? Mm. Or does, you know, is this a contagion?
Mm. I talk about it in a sense in the book as a form of contagion. When we're seeing this ramping up of fear and threat scenarios and emergencies around borders, often involving quite small numbers, we should recall most immigrants in the United States don't enter, are not the ones who are now being sort of broadcast on television as this major entry. Similarly, in the European case, overland migrants towards Europe, certainly if we take the year of 2015 out of the equation, or a relatively small minority of overall migration. But we're seeing here again and again this sort of ramping up of emergency rhetoric that's very easily spread through both social media and traditional media, and that certain politicians as well are very adept at using and are sometimes copying one from the other, from one context to the other. But I think we need to look, and that's part of what I do in the book, look at both the political gains to be had from this and the economic logics underlying it. So on the one hand, there are clear short-sighted political gains from engaging in this sort of emergency politics. rather than taking the longer view and dampening down the rhetoric and trying to find a more humane, sustainable way of approaching these large-scale structural phenomena such as migration, violence, displacement, and so on. But there are also economic gains, and there are gains in terms of how, as I said, core Western powers, interveners, may be able to, through their operations, maybe they are creating a larger problem in the long run, but in the short run they can push the problem somewhere else. They can contain it in border regions on the other side of these divides. So it's in that sense quite an efficient way in a very cynical, short-sighted sense of dealing with it through a politics of risk and fear. And we also see a lot of economic interest coming into that, both on the side of the defense contractors providing the equipment, the border and security agencies and militaries who are engaging in these fights, as well on the other side of the border, the partner regimes who see higher and higher stakes in this. And in fact, time and again can ramp up the rhetoric around emergencies and fears to ask for more favors, as it were, from the Western funders of the operations. And we've seen that across Africa in recent years in terms of migration, for instance.
Is the solution to this? Is it a question of just simply there has to be a different political will? Because it seems like, you know, we've certainly had eras where the execution of policies which would dampen the danger to the extent that it's real. We've had policies in the past, right? Is it just a question of political will? Is it a question? I mean, how does this? Because it feels like we're in sort of a feedback loop, to a certain extent. What is it that takes us out of that feedback loop?
Yeah, it's a bit what I describe in the book as a negative spiral where we keep escalating the sort of emergency in a sense, the sense of fear, the sense of threat and anxiety that keeps worsening the situation and pulling in more and more actors into this way of seeing the world based around security and danger and so on. And certainly, I think part of what we need to do is to go back into history and see this is a pretty recent moment when these fears are being mapped onto the world in this particular way. Certainly when it comes to migration, the post-war years in the United States and Europe saw large-scale legal circular migration labor programs. They were not perfect, but they were certainly better than the kind of violent, dangerous routes and sense of emergency we've seen at the borders ever since these legal pathways started closing and were replaced by fences and barriers. Similarly, the collaboration with neighboring states, whether it's the case of Mexico, Central America, around human migration and trade, or whether it's a case of Europe and Africa that's now increasingly focused on containing migration at any cost, providing funding for often unchecked security outfits and regimes. That can be framed in a completely different way. And again, not so many years ago, we saw a more positive narrative around modernization, development, economic opportunity that, again, wasn't perfect, but it can certainly be revived. It's still there to some extent. But it can certainly get back and get the upper hand and perhaps be retooled for a new era. And for this to happen, I think part of what needs to go on is a different narrative, a different political narrative, and in a way a remapping of our world away from these divided maps that we're seeing, where we're projecting all these fears and dangers outside of our territories, and instead trying to assume more of a responsibility for our fundamentally structural, systemic challenges. These are not place-bound, people-bound threats that are somehow far away, not belonging to us. We are fundamentally implicated in finding a solution to questions of human mobility, displacement, violence and conflict. And part of that is to do with finding another narrative, a more positive narrative for these collaborations with poorer countries in crisis-hit parts of the world.
No-Go World, How Fear is Redrawing Our Maps and Infecting Our Politics. Ruben Anderson, thanks so much for your time today. We'll put the book, link to the book at majority.fm. Again, thanks for your time.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye. All right, folks. There you have it. We're going to take a quick break, head into the fun half of the program, wherein we will have fun. We have Nancy Pelosi at the Pete Peterson Foundation today.
Super fun.
Saying those words makes me nauseous. She's always been a big Pete Peterson fan. But the idea that you would go and promote deficit hawkery at this time, really any time, but at this time in particular, is shocking. Political malpractice. Even if you, I don't know, even if you really thought like your entire objective in government was to close the deficit, it still would be just the dumbest thing in the world to do right now.
Talk about rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic.
It's not, it's worse than that. It is not rearranging the deck chairs, because at least you'd be rearranging the deck chairs. This is literally like blowing another hole in the Titanic.
Well, Pete Buttigieg was on Desus and Mero's Showtime show, and he talked about that thing. And it wasn't a good interview. It was kind of embarrassing for everybody. But he was talking about that thing about where you can say certain things to certain audiences, but then it eventually gets around to everybody.
Right.
And Pelosi thinks, like, oh, I'm with Manu Raji at the Pete Peterson Foundation. People that know that this deficit stuff is BS won't ever find out what I'm saying here.
No, I don't think so. I don't think. Frankly, I think that's part of the problem. Like, I just don't, I think that she thinks that she doesn't think that there are people who would have that much of a problem with it. Well, we'll get into it in a moment, because it's so nuts.
Pete Pearson was a great man. What the hell do you know?
Is that Susan Collins? Yeah.
Basically. Well, no, it's distorted tape drunk Nancy Pelosi.
Which is Susan
I'm doing
Collins.
It, which is Susan Collins. Susan.
We're going to take a quick break, head into the fun half. Just a reminder, your support makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% juicy off your coffee, tea, or chocolate. I don't know. I just wanted to...
Okay.
I say the same thing every day. I've said probably the same thing.
Innovation is good.
What show? What number show are we on? Like 2020? Do we even mark our 2000th show?
No, we blew past it, and then like somebody reminded us, and we're like, yeah.
We did.
We're not sentimental.
We did the 2019.
When we get to the 10,000th show.
Oh, okay.
You know what's amazing? By the 10,000th show, I feel like China will have like a naval presence like across the Caribbean, and somehow Nancy Pelosi will still be in charge of the Democrats in Congress.
You know, definitely.
That we need
I will
to
be
cut.
Around 100, right? If we did 2,000 shows in the course of eight and a half years. So to get 10,000, 40 years total, so 30 years from now. Oh, no, I'll still be 82. I'll be Nancy Pelosi's age. I will literally be her age.
And you'll be like, Nancy Pelosi was wrong to give that, to say at her 130th birthday that we should cut Social Security.
The impression bits are going to be so convoluted by that time.
Oh, yeah. God. When you start adding timelines. Jesus Christ.
Hey, get calling on the teleporter line. Listen, that teleporter's really bad. But what do you keep referencing this thing from 4 years ago? What? How about some new material?
The show will be totally incomprehensible to anyone who's been listening for less than 50 years.
Right, exactly. I'm sorry, you're not part of the 50-year. I was explaining.
Michael's on another meditation.
I was explaining
retreat.
To Brendan
he
that, like, how easily you could lose touch if you were Nancy Pelosi. Where I was saying, like, because so much of your political, I think it's true with everything, to a large extent, for most people, not all people, so much of your knowledge base that you operate on are formed in, you know, formative years for that for her politically probably happened. I mean, you know, Ryan Grimm was talking about this yesterday, you know, 30, 40 years ago. And she's still operating under those same assumptions and whatnot. And I was trying to use an analogy. It was like, Matt understands that I like, you know, 90s music, the kind of music, and you find like you can extrapolate that to music that exists today. But I'm like, when I'm 80, we have somebody's Matt's age, is going to be sitting at the board, is going to have no idea about that music.
Pelosi talks about D-Day like I talk about the 72 and 10 Chicago Bulls.
Right. I mean, it's a little bit way off. It's also really weird.
And you draw the analogy like you're our age too. Same shit.
It is weird to sort of like assess, particularly
Harvey
when you have
Kay
kids.
Harvey is having a conniption right now.
Like when, and I look at like my daughter and I think that like, I can't remember, like the distance between her and Kurt Cobain, my daughter is like twice as large as it was for me at her age between me and the Beatles. And I'm like, what? Because the Beatles seemed like forever ago when I was 14. And, you know, the idea that Kurt Cobain is twice the distance from my daughter at age 14 than the Beatles were for me at age 14 is pretty stunning.
Time.
I mean,
the
even but even for like us, like I don't, you were like an adult when he committed suicide.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's wild.
You know, there are people being born today who are younger than anyone ever before.
Yes.
Dude.
Think about it. It's like, my daughter doesn't even know who Kurt Cobain is. And I was reading an actuerial report. And I was getting really high. And
I will
like,
say, like,
my daughter
when
doesn't
I was,
know Kurt Cobain.
When
is.
I was when I was 10,
that means the Foo Fighters won't even be remembered.
But when I was 10, the distance between World War II and was 30 years earlier, and we've almost doubled that time since then. Like, and I can tell you, World War II seemed like a long time ago when I was 10, and.
Like Iran-Contra.
Yeah, exactly.
You
all
know
right.
What? I got hope for Generation Z. I got to say, they're a lot more. I mean, they scare me a little bit in some ways. They're just like feral children of the internet. But they, a lot of them are really into Marx. And I think they might save us.
Well, hope springs eternal.
Yeah.
Speaking of Generation Z, tonight's Tuesday. What's up, Michael?
Wow.
I'm tired.
Is it because you're contemplating your mortality that you were so?
I'm tired.
Yeah. Okay. I get it. Go. Just drift off. Tonight, before the main show, we're doing a live stream with Kyle Kalinske, and we're going to be talking about some of the new this progressive economic pledge. Kyle also has requested, but he would like to do a little bit of Dave Rubin dunking with me, which is. Seems to be a thing that people like to get in on. And then we're going to debate a little bit of what is the difference between a socialist internationalism versus left-wing isolationism. And we're not going to make that about particular. We're going to try to get out of the granular and out of the candidate sort of bickering and actually see if there is like a philosophical and positional difference there that's useful to think about. Then in the main show, Glenn Greenwald is going to come on about this massive, massive Lavajato story, and then Bhaskar Sunkara and Ben Burgess are both going to be in studio, and we're going to talk about the German SDP, the history of socialism, and what models might actually be relevant to the United States in 2019 for greater freedom and democracy in our economy. Patreon.com/TMBS. Michael Brooks Show on YouTube, where we're getting close to our first 50,000 subscribers on YouTube, so hit subscribe.
Jamie.
Out now, or actually, I'm sorry, I fucked that up. Out tomorrow on the Antifada, we have on Ben Burgess. He was great on the Majority Report. He's great on TMBS. Spoiler alert, he's also great on the Antifada.
He had a great time. He texted me.
Oh, that's so nice. Yeah, we talk all about logic and why the left needs it. And, you know, We put our little Antifada spin on it, so it won't be boring to people who've already seen him on these shows. That's out tomorrow. Check it out, folks.
Literary Hangover. Check out the... patrons are enjoying the Orweller series that I've been doing. Check that out. And Margaret Fuller, I'll get that episode up on YouTube soon. Also, if we have any electronic music composers... that do sort of instrumental electronic music. Think like Keter Levininsky or Aphex Twin or like Caribou or something like that. Get in touch with me at Matt Lech on Twitter, MattLech, because I have a project that I might be interested in. So we'll update you as that develops.
Quick break. Fun half.
Left is best.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
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 You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2. 5/8. 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Grandpa.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up. Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me...
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.